Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, this is going to be a fun one.
Hey, this is going to be a lot of fun. We got a studio full. We've got observers. We got paparazzi. We got people who have been on the Business Radio X microphone before. And we have some new friends in the studio. So it is going to be a fantastic show today. First up on Atlanta Business Radio, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast Chief Marketing Officer with CallRail, Miss Mary Pat Donnellan. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Well, Mary Pat, can you share a little bit about CallRail? How are you serving folks?
Yeah, so CallRail is a call analytics solution that helps businesses and digital marketing agencies that serve those businesses understand exactly what makes the drives the phone calls that come in to their business and how those calls perform. So that's a little bit much to wrap your head around. So sometimes I like to maybe give an example
of how that works.
So to help that make sense, let's pretend you're a service business.
Okay. What business am I?
Like a, you decide.
Okay. I'm a pest control.
Okay. Perfect. You're a pest control business. You're setting up your website. You're doing advertising. You can use Google to see all the visitors to your site, who's clicking on what. But the main way you're getting clients is because of the phone calls coming in. So CallRail allows you to see exactly who called and how they got to you. So it's very interesting in the world today. Mobile click-to-call is driving huge amounts and increases in phone volume.
So they're
finding
me on their phone, not on like the website as much as before.
Well, but they might find you on your website, but from the phone. Yeah. So you pick up your phone. You're going to search. That's how probably most of us do that when we're looking for things. You see, there is Lee's Pest Control. There's a phone number. I'm going to click on it.
And then I click, and then I'm just, like right now, I'm just kind of learning, so I don't want to make a decision. So, but you're my, if I'm the consumer, I'm pressing Lee's Pest Control.
Yeah.
And what do now Lee's Pest Control know about me?
What we know about you is who you are and what activity or what ad or listing drove you or keyword drove you to make that phone call.
So now previously, you wouldn't know that.
Right. You might be investing in advertising in Google, Facebook. Maybe you even took out an ad in a community paper and you're getting phone calls, but you wouldn't know what actually which activity drove that phone call. So with CallRail, you can actually understand the marketing activities that are driving to your business.
What's effective and what's not.
Exactly. So you can optimize your spend.
Mm-hmm. So now, do you spend most of your time working with agencies or you spend most of your time working with the end business?
Both. A lot of times we're working directly with the end businesses, but a primary vehicle to work with those end businesses is through marketing agencies. If you're Lee's Pest Control and you're working with a digital marketing agency, you're going to want them to be able to show the value that they're providing. And CallRail is a perfect way for them to do that and help manage the performance of the work that they're doing for you and to be very clear on the ROI that they're providing.
Now, you're kind of new in the role, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit about your background? What got you here?
Yeah, absolutely. So my immediate preceding position was as vice president of marketing for Blackbaud in Charleston, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. So I have recently joined CallRail. Super excited to be here. At Blackbaud, I was responsible for our marketing tech stack and responsible for things like marketing attribution and understanding the effectiveness of our advertisements, et cetera. So I was a consumer of similar technologies, not exactly CallRail, but other technologies.
But you were aware of CallRail?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I it's really fun to be a consumer of that, but now to be on the other side, working with other marketers like myself.
So now, is this your first CMO job?
Yep, it sure is.
So now, how do you go about kind of attacking that? What's your first, like, 100 days look like?
Well, I have some very specific 90-day priorities laid out. But to be candid, the very first thing that I want to do is get deep into the market and the solution and the team. Mm-hmm. So while we're doing a lot of things right away, and we certainly have a lot of opportunity clearly that we're going after, it's very important to take the time, especially at the beginning, to build the foundation of getting my team in great position to succeed, understanding all the roles and responsibilities, both my marketing team, but the entire CallRail team. Getting out, talking to customers,
right.
Potential customers, agencies, and then also spending time with the product itself so that I can speak to it clearly and understand and basically translate the value on a broad scale.
Had CallRail had a CMO before?
No. Mm-mm.
So you're
first
both learning
time.
Together.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So that's exciting,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
So now I was telling you before the show that we had the pleasure to interview the CallRail folks at Startup Riot in 2012. So yes. That was towards the beginning of their journey. And that happens a lot here that we get them before there's something and now there's something. And they've expanded quite a bit in those 6 years, right? That they're
significantly. Yes, yes.
So can you talk about the growth, how they've kind of really, they got obviously a product that's resonating. They have lots of customers now all over. Is it global or is it?
It is global, yes. Yes, we do have 90,000 businesses using CallRail.
Right.
So it is pretty massive. We've been recognized with many growth awards from Inc., Atlanta Pacesetters, the last 5 years in a row, and have received significant funding to continue to grow and expand. So
now,
it's
is the growth
exciting.
Looking to be kind of still Atlanta-based? Is it that's the objective?
Is to be Atlanta-based.
And
yes.
to continue the growth, because I know that you're doing a lot to serve the Atlanta community as well. That's important, right?
Yeah. So I guess maybe what I think is so exciting about CallRail and why I think maybe the secret sauce of its growth, and I don't want to be too presumptuous in saying that since I've just joined, but what I would say is CallRail is a great company. It's got a great solution, but it has great heart. And I think that manifests itself. It is a very customer-centric company. And the product is completely engineered to make an amazing customer experience. And everyone there is very driven by building the absolute best solution for the customers, making it a delightful, wonderful, easy, great experience. And that's really at the heart of what CallRail is. CallRail's also really great with employees and really is focused on having a terrific culture that's welcoming, inclusive, motivating, and giving all the folks there a very stimulating environment where they can grow and try new things and develop their careers. And I think what's really interesting, and they're doing all that in Atlanta. So we're building great careers here in Atlanta of people who probably will go see the next iteration of tech in Atlanta. And I think it's a role model to companies like really focusing on the product, the team, and then the growth and the success follows that. So,
and also at the heart of it, serving the community is an important component.
Absolutely. Yes. And I think we serve the community by making these great jobs and being a great company, growing in downtown, all those things. And of course, we do have regular service projects as a team, and that's part of our culture and,
right.
Yeah, exactly. So that's part of that warm culture where we're out doing things together and not just inward focused, but outward focused.
Now, are you looking to hire? Or are you looking to expand in Atlanta?
Well, yes. Yes, yes. We have two floors today at 100 Peachtree, known as the Equitable Building.
Sure.
And we have just signed a lease for two more floors. And we expect to be adding about 300 more jobs over the next 5 or so years. So
now the types of jobs, do you know what they're going to be?
Engineering, a lot of engineering and product development roles. Certainly, I will be hiring and marketing. So any great marketers listening to this, please reach out, and engineers as well.
You'll probably need some radio host, I would think.
And yes, radio host. Maybe we'll go to TV. You never know. But yes, so I would say all over, we have customer success, support, marketing, sales, engineering, et cetera. So I would say all over, but probably the biggest focus is engineering because at the heart, we're building a great product. And then I'm, of course, going to promote marketing as well.
Now, from a marketing standpoint, I know it's still early on, but is some of your marketing mix that you're going to go put out there, is it kind of the usual suspects in terms of you're going to create a lot of thought leadership? You're going to, you know, do you do trade shows? Like, what are some of the areas that you are going to look to do marketing?
Yeah, sure thing. So one of the ways CallRail's super strong today is we have an amazing inbound digital program. So again, we're working with digital marketers and we're very good at digital marketing. So I walked into a great environment where that is really a well-oiled machine that's running very well. Where I see, and we do trade shows. In fact, we had a team out in Seattle at MozCon this week. We're going to be at Digital Summit Denver next week. So we are out and about all over promoting as our customers are everywhere. Sure. And our potential customers are everywhere. But where I see a lot of opportunity is to engage and educate a little bit more. So going back to, as you mentioned, thought leadership, we have an opportunity to do more of that. I think we do a great job of capturing all the people that know about call analytics and what's possible and getting them to become clients. What we can have a big opportunity is to educate more of the market about how a solution like CallRail can help them grow. And do that in multi-channel ways. So, you know, the whole thing from email, digital, social, events, et cetera, but doing it in a very cohesive way and speaking to people where they are in their buyer's journey.
Right. And then just kind of capture maybe the real life stories of how they're using the product and how they're succeeding with this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We all know that people buy from people and a peer reference is about the most valuable thing that you can have. So we want to foster that in all kinds of ways through written case studies, video case studies, having advocates because we have so many fans because, as I mentioned, it's a great product. And it's like hard to imagine maybe that people love call analytics solution, but they do love CallRail. So we have a chance to really harness that and get our advocates advocating for us on social media and other places as well. So we've got a good baseline there, but there's a lot of opportunity to grow sharing that.
What are you looking most forward to in the coming year?
Well, for me,
it's just getting settled here in Atlanta. That's enough of a goal.
Well, yeah. So it's exciting all the way around. I think it's really fun to be with a hyper growth company and to figure out my opportunity is to really find, take advantage of all the opportunity we see, but to do that in a very scalable, repeatable way so that we can capture and harness all the opportunity and growth ahead of us. We need to do that in a way that keeps our culture tight because we have something really good. So as we get more scalable, repeatable, process-oriented, we don't want to lose who we are. And really what I love is building things. And so for me to be able to be on the it's not the ground floor because it's been around. CallRail's been here since 2011. But part of maybe this next iteration of major growth is really fun and exciting to me. And getting to learn and know Atlanta on top of that is
Bonus,
awesome,
right?
Too. Sure thing.
Now, can you share a little bit about the pain that a customer is having where that CallRail's the solution?
Yeah. So if I'm a marketing agency, we'll just talk about it through that lens. You know, marketing agencies today, they really need, they're always worried, if I have a marketing agency, how do I get more clients? How do I show value and ROI to the clients that I have so that they want to stay with me? We've seen some trends where a lot of some businesses are bringing kind of their digital marketing in-house. I think for agencies, it's going to be really, really important for them to show their value through ROI, and CallRail is a great way to do that. And we know that from the agencies we're working with. So the pain is, how do I show my value to a client? And CallRail is the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. So that's from the agency. What about from the customer directly?
Yeah.
The business
so
directly?
The other, you're Lee's Pest Control,
right,
and you have a small budget and you're trying to make good business decisions. I'm sure you could spend unlimited sums with Google every day,
right?
Or Facebook every day, but you have it in your interest to make sure that you're doing the right things and making your marketing investments wisely so that you're getting that return. And CallRail is going to allow you to do that. You've seen, and historically, that's been the problem with marketing. You invest all this time, you do all these activities, but you have no idea. You've spent the money, but what actually drove the business in? Without that, you're really flying blind. So if you want to grow and expand, a tool like CallRail is really critical. And you can really double down on the things that are working and stop the things that aren't.
Well, welcome to Atlanta.
Super glad to be here.
We are delighted to have you. And please keep up the good work.
Will do. Thanks.
So where can our listeners go if they'd like to reach out and have a conversation with you or someone on your team about some of these topics?
Yep. I encourage everyone to visit CallRail.com. We actually have a 14-day free trial. So if any of this has piqued your interest, you can try it for yourself and see what I'm talking about. And I think you'll experience firsthand that amazing, delightful experience and of our solution. And then feel free to email me at marypat@callrail.com.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for sharing your story. We look forward to continuing to follow it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. How about staying with us? We're going to visit with a couple more guests this morning.
Okay.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, please join me in welcoming to this show no stranger to the Business Radio X microphone, founder and CEO with Moto Moto Agency, Miss Moira Vetter. How you doing?
I'm good. Good morning.
Well, it is good to have you back. What have you been up to since we talked to you last?
Oh, growing, growing, growing.
Well, that's good.
Can you share a little bit about Moto Moto? How are you serving folks?
Yeah, we are a strategic brand firm here in Atlanta, and we've been in business going on 11 years. So, you know, one of the things we really enjoy is long-term relationships and being able to see how over time brands evolve, marketing challenges change. You know, some of the things Mary Pat was talking about in terms of technologies changing and the stack changing, which has, you know, radically impacted how marketing occurs. And so we are working with our clients to ensure that they have their positioning clear, they have their brand developed appropriately, and then they are activating in the market in the ways that both provide some of those quick wins that people want, but also the really critical long-term, you know, growth activities.
So now you specifically mentioned brand in your description of your firm. How is that different than a digital marketing firm or a more traditional advertising agency?
That's a wonderful question that we have been pondering with Gartner. We have a relationship with Gartner, and honestly, they said drop any word in front. Just say you're an agency. Because there are so many categories, it's almost meaningless at this point. And on any given day, I could tell you we're a digital agency, we're a brand agency, we're a strategic agency. Sometimes we're a B2B agency because we do have a heavy footprint in B2B. But the main thing really, in our case, because we are so focused on strategic growth and long-term growth, you know, a business building itself in the world and its brand is so much more than marketing activity or a marketing plan. And so, you know, brand, really, we just keep coming back to brand. And you know, brand and customer experience and alignment, those things together. You know, not brand as in identity marks and design, but brand as in who are we in the world and how do we, you know, create that experience with people.
And you find that today's consumer still values brand?
Increasingly, we do. And, you know, I don't know if millennials having taken hold, I think, you know, they appreciate brand. I mean, they are among the most skeptical people, but they also are the biggest lovers of brand. So, you know, I definitely think, and particularly in the B2B space, and I've been in this industry for almost 30 years, brand was a very bad word for a long time because it meant spending a lot of money for things that we can't track. You know, it's the John Wanamaker dilemma, right? We spend all this money on marketing and half of it works. The problem is we don't know which half. And, you know, I think that high growth companies, very strategic companies, understand that there has to be a core, there has to be a fundamental thing, and that that brand is not just so they can sell, it's so they can grow, it's so they can recruit employees, it's so that they can be fixtures of their community, you know, it's so everybody can feel proud about this thing that they're on about doing, you know, not the least of which is the customer, but not only the customer, it's that whole thing. So that's that.
So you believe that even though that the younger people tend to be more, I think, less brand loyal, you think there's still at the core there is some brand loyalty?
I absolutely do. But for the companies that truly are anchored on the consumer, you know, I feel that, you know, I'm a great example. Okay, I only have a Macintosh computer, and get ready for laughter, I only use a BlackBerry. And, you know, I take a lot of crap for this BlackBerry, but I will have the last BlackBerry that they make, and then I'll move on to whatever that next brand is. I do feel that when people have been delighted with the thing, again, whether it's call, I couldn't track these calls for 20 years we've been doing this, and now I can do it. Oh my gosh, eureka. You know, some of the, again, many of the things that I'm most loyal about right now are the technologies I use. You know, I mean, certainly I'm tend to be a loyal person and I like things, but, you know, I do feel like if you're truly focused on customer experience and delight, I mean, I think the word delight is really important because it's not just, yeah, like it works. You have to be like, oh my gosh, my life was so much different before this, whatever it is, the car that I'm driving, the phone that I'm using, the clothes that I'm wearing that fit better, whatever that is. When you are delighted, you are loyal. And, you know, the impact, the ripples that the delighted brand, you know, loyal consumer bases have is just, you know, incomparable.
So now from a, when you're kind of working with your clients, how do you move them kind of intellectually from the idea from more transactionally minded to this more relationship minded kind of thinking so that they do create that delight? Because you, if you're just trying to burn and churn through customers and you don't care about them and you just want the next one, it's hard to create that delight because you're not even thinking in those terms.
Well, I think, you know, one of the benefits to being an agency is you are an outside voice, outside eyeballs. And, you know, clients when, you know, and clients, whatever, the CMO, the CEO, the head of sales, the people that we work with, when they get into the throes of the day to day, they completely can lose focus, right? If you're implementing a new marketing tech stack, for instance, you are so focused on which boxes are we going to click and how many attribution qualities do we need to have? And, you know, and you could lose sight of some huge trend has just occurred in the market that wiped out half our competitors, and we have this huge market opportunity because I'm so focused on the marketing tech stack and we're all talking about how we want to attribute. And so being that agency really enables you to be advocating for the customer and advocating for the customer's experience and sometimes being the only one that will come in and honestly tell them what that is. You know, I mean, customer service people are going to put great customer service reports in front of their executives and salespeople are going to have the best sales results possible so that the commissions are up. And an agency can come in and say, well, let's go to calls, for example. I remember years ago, we had done a direct mail campaign at a previous firm that I was with. And the client was furious because they weren't getting enough call volume. And it turned out that the call line had been disrupted. Somebody hadn't renewed the 800. So the number was not on. Okay. And so, I mean, sometimes it is so basic to connect the dots between your salespeople don't speak to each other. You know, your product strategy, you've got this very inward focused engineering and ops thing, and you haven't actually had your product teams and your engineers speak to a real live customer in 3 years. So it's those kinds of things where if we can either shed a light on that for them or force them to do that or bring that into them and then help them find ways to, you know, harness that and build that insight into the brand.
And whether businesses realize it or not, even if you're not investing in branding, you're still branding.
Oh, yeah.
In the mind of the consumer, they're still going to have an opinion about you and put you in a certain box, whether
totally.
You're putting any effort towards it or not.
Yes. There is an old saying about, you know, you should design what you are going to be, because if you don't, someone else will design it for you. And that is true with the brand. You know, if you ignore it and you're just selling, right? I'm selling and I'm checking how our profit margin looks. You know, those companies have brands. You know, again, there are millions of companies that don't use agencies, don't do marketing, but they absolutely have brands. Some of them are weak and some of them are that lucky miracle.
And they may not even be aware of what their brand is in the eye of the consumer. They
totally.
Could think that they've got it figured out because everybody in the room knows what they do and how they do it. So now when you're working with a client or a prospective client, do you have a typical point of entry where you come in, or are they hiring you as an agency of record usually, or what's the
agencies,
how does the relationship go?
Now, agencies of record are really dying. You know, not only is the structure of the contract is really not in everybody's best interest. And it's very, I don't know, it's a thing of the past. And there's been a lot of talk about, you know, that structural relationship. Now, I still feel that agencies themselves are hugely relevant, just not as a traditional agency of record kind of relationship was structured in the past. But in our case, when we are working with the proper clients for us, we are coming in at a C-suite level. Let me reframe that. If they are a mid-market high-growth company, we are at the C-suite level. If they are a billion-plus, we are at an SVP level of some kind. So someone that has a real strategic growth initiative, a huge business problem, you know, some real hairball that they're working on and somebody has given them the authority to go fix this, grow this, change, evolve, transform. Often that is a CMO. Sometimes it is the CEO. It has even been the CFO on occasion because they wanted, a firm who could actually speak to full business value and be responsible with a marketing spend. Increasingly the titles, the reason we always talk about the C-suite is, you know, the COO can become the CMO now. CFOs are becoming CMOs. You know, everybody's changing seats. So to me, it's less about we come in through the marketing door. We come in through the strategic
folder. But is it usually through a project, or are they saying, look, we need kind of holistic help here, so I need you to look at the whole picture?
It's both of those things. It's holistic help, but it is around a burning thing. And then,
like, what's an example of some of the burning things you've been brought in on?
So we have been the market leader in this space for 7 years and never did marketing and never branded and have these absolutely amazing relationships with, you know, the top 50 whatevers in the world. And all of a sudden there have been these new entrants to the market that have really aggressively invested in brand. And so, you know, they're quickly losing market share or losing there's the perception they're losing market share when in fact they may be the market leader, but they have not properly developed their brand to express that. You know, other things, we have several clients, and particularly those in the $1 billion and up space, where there are always a tremendous number of strategic initiatives going on. And so sometimes it is, we have got to take what used to be a collection of products and solutions and some platform stuff and figure out what is it. And then, by the way, We've been operating like a product company for the last 25 years, and we've got to get more consumer focused. We've got to stop doing product launches, product pushes, product promotions, product social, you know, product thought leadership. We actually want to focus on the customer, and we'll connect the dots between those things. So that really, that one is huge. And then also, again, we were talking, Mary Pat was talking about recruitment and how critical that is. And we do a lot of work to crystallize growing or transforming brands for the internal team as well as the external team. And that's huge when you're looking for talent and, if you're growing rapidly, it's the game of telephone on who is this company and what are we about and what do we do? So making sure that there's that alignment in place so that the scale can keep occurring.
So now what's your take on the Atlanta market? Do you see them as are you bullish on Atlanta in terms of creativity and growth?
I am way bullish on Atlanta. This is such an amazing market. I came here in 1987, and it is astounding what has happened here. And not because it wasn't already a leading community in 1987, but the amount of huge wins that we have as a city and the way that that impacts every piece of the community, the culture, the art, the living, the communities, the properties, everything. It's such a rich community here. And I think many people, and I'm a contributor with Forbes. And so, four or five times a month, I'm talking to CEOs and, I often end up speaking with people. I handle entrepreneurship and high growth entrepreneurship, and I'll end up talking to a lot of Silicon Valley people. And we're still this best kept secret in terms of, from a consumer point of view, I would say, the amount of technology leadership we have here, the backbone, the financial backbone that we have, the number of, Fortune 100 companies that we have here and what that creates as a center. So I couldn't be more thrilled about Atlanta. I'm very involved in the Atlanta community. We do, things with the Atlanta Chamber. I feel like having been here when we got the Olympics in 96, I remember there was already a real thriving technology community here coming into 96. And 96 was this big opportunity to upgrade the city, right? The same way you build a stadium and you change a community, and it seems like that stuff lasts a decade, right? But the Olympics were a big opportunity for us to kind of raise our level of our playing field. And then I kind of feel like in the 2000s, it was like, now what's our big anchor event, And I think finally people have we are winning corporate headquarters left and right. We are fixing these roads, which, it has to happen. Right. The airport continues to be on that list where you can get anywhere in 2 hours to, 80% of the businesses in the country. It's just that we have so many things that are working together. Not the least of which, and this is really critical, it goes back to the ability to recruit the talent pool that we have here. And we have it here, plus people are flocking here. It's unbelievable to me, having been in our business for 11 years, particularly being not only a technology center and a corporate leadership center, but a creativity center. It used to be we would only consider Atlanta applicants for a job because we're not going to deal with relocation and, blah, blah, blah. Over the last few years, it is astounding to me how many people from, New York and South Carolina, Kentucky, up wherever they are. Oh, no, I'm moving to Atlanta. I would like to work with you, but I'm not moving to work, at your firm or any firm. I'm coming for Atlanta. And then I'm going, so I need to find an employer because I'm coming. And that, so to me, that also really speaks to the strength of our community. And, I'm obviously a true believer, right? But I've done so much work on Atlanta and Atlanta's visibility and Atlanta's positioning. I just contributed to a piece in the Atlantic City Lab, and they were looking at, the Amazon HQ2 competition you know, for the headquarters.
Right.
And so, you know, they wanted some perspective on, you know, what do site developers do and what do economic development teams have to do to put, you know, a region's best foot forward. And it was very easy to, you know, do my little contribution because I feel like we check so many boxes. And so for me, having a growing, scaling business here, it's amazing mm-hmm. because that means we will have clients and we will have a team of talent to keep growing to support. So, yeah.
Well, it's an exciting time for Atlanta, and it continues to be an exciting journey mm-hmm. for you.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. So where can our listeners go if they want to talk to you, somebody on your team?
Mm-hmm. So modoagency.com, and that's modoagency.com. Also at Twitter, at everywhere else, right? And I'm on Twitter at Moira Vetter.
All right. Hey, stay with us. We got one more guest we're going to visit with. All right, Lee, you ready for the headliner?
I am.
He's been very patient. I think he might have picked up a few things. He may have learned something. He seemed to be engaged in the other conversations. I thought I caught him taking a note or two, but it's time. Please join me in welcoming to the Atlanta Business Radio Show, architect and photographer with Blake Burton Photography, none other than the man himself, Blake Burton. How are you, man?
Good. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Delighted. So what'd you learn in those last two conversations? Anything you can use?
You know, I work full-time at an architecture firm, and I'm kind of picking up a few things that I might have to relay back to the folks back in the office for sure.
Well, Blake, you're here to talk about this new photography book focused on Ponce City Market. Can you share a little bit about that project? How did that get started?
Yeah, so this started back in 2009. I graduated architecture school right in the middle of the recession and was unable to locate a job in the architecture field. And I was lucky enough to be hired at the City of Atlanta in their asset management office, and one of their assets was the old Sears building, then right. known as City Hall East. And at that time, they were prepping the building to be sold. Nobody told us who they were selling it to or what was going to happen to it, but one of my responsibilities was to go to the building every day and supervise the crew that was starting to clean out the building, because it was decades of accumulated trash and debris and just storage.
So it was just a mess at that point?
It was. The City of Atlanta had about 15 or 20% of the building occupied, and the rest was just left. Whatever Sears left was just left in place.
Right. So that it was a Sears distribution center?
That's correct. So it opened in 1926, and it shut its doors in 1989 when the city bought it.
So now that's like from their catalog business. They would have stuff there.
Oh, yeah.
And then they would
yeah.
just ship it out.
Right. They had the retail stores on the first floor, and then they had full distribution throughout the Southeast. So they had a lot of the area. There's a Memphis store, there's a Dallas store. So they had a pretty good sizable chunk of territory to cover here in the Southeast.
I even shopped there.
Really?
Before they closed it. I did.
We hear countless stories from folks that I went to the Christmas market there, to the toy market, the farmer's market, that sort of thing. So a lot of people have a very special connection to the building.
So you were just wandering around with a camera, just taking cool pictures of stuff
That's
you found
right.
interesting?
Yeah. So lunch breaks or right after work would wrap up. I'd tell my boss, hey, I'm going to go take off and explore a new floor. And so every day for a few months when the work was happening, I would see something completely different. And
because they were uncovering walls or like they
at
were
that time, not yet. They were just bringing down leftover stuff. There was stuff left over from the Olympics that were down there, the old carts that they had in Centennial Olympic Park, lots of random stuff. And so trash was coming down. And so I was unsure what was going to happen to the building, and thought that that was the right time and to document before thinking that it might be demolished.
Had you ever done that type of documentation?
No.
So you were just a guy with a camera.
I was just wandering around. A couple times I asked my boss if I can just come in on a Saturday and just wander around all day. And he was like, yeah, no problem. Just sign in at the desk. And you know.
So what were some of the things that you were finding that where you're like, oh, this is kind of cool. Maybe there is something here that's interesting.
So I think the coolest thing to me, being that I have the background in architecture, was the blueprints of the building dating back to 1926 that were just left in a cabinet there. And the City of Atlanta also had a lot of their plans of their assets in that building as well. And a lot of them, they just maybe they had copies, enough copies. The rest they just kind of left behind. And so some of it's starting to get trashed. And so I came across a giant blueprint cabinet that had the plans for the building and all the modifications they had done since the building started construction. And I think that was probably the coolest thing that I found.
Did they have kind of a mock-up of what they envisioned it to be?
To become Ponce City Market?
No, before that, when it was the Sears, but was it the way they wanted it to be?
Yeah, so it was done in several phases. They added on, after the original building opened in 1926, they added a new wing 3 years later, and then about 10 years later, another new wing. I mean,
so they were growing like crazy.
Oh, yeah, they grew. I think the last addition was 1968.
Right, they were Amazon before Amazon.
Exactly, yeah, they were the powerhouse distributor for sure, so...
And then, this was a key part of their whole United States operation, right?
Yeah, it was. It was a huge component. Like I said, it covered a lot. I mean, basically the entire Southeast, and they were, you know, sending packages, and then the retail store would bring folks in from here locally. So it was a big operation.
Was it touching rail at that time in the 20s?
Yeah. So the Atlanta Beltline that we see now, that part of that rail came right into the building. Mm-hmm. And so that was a major, you know, artery for their
So that's why it was located where it was, because it was touching a rail system that they can get stuff in and out pretty easily.
Yeah, at the time it was a little bit out of the city, downtown core, and they saw the potential of the railroad, and then eventually they transitioned to trucks and saw the potential of the car. And so that's where they, you know, sort of stopped using the railroad. In fact, one of the additions covered up the railroad extension that came into the building because they recognized the need that the car was going to... Yeah.
Now, for you, once you found out it was Ponce City Market, were you familiar with Jamestown's work?
Not really. I did a little bit of searching. I noticed that they had worked on Chelsea Market in New York City. And when I saw that, I was like, okay, we know pretty clearly what they're going to do now.
Right.
Because it was a similar condition, old factory building, and they turned into... You know, office, residential.
Have you been to Chelsea Market?
I did, actually, for the first time 2 weeks ago.
Okay, so you saw that it's very similar.
Yeah, very similar. Very crowded, too.
Right. So now, you took the project from before it was Ponce City all the way through to
That's
what
correct.
It is today?
Yeah, so when the building was sold, our work was done, and I was fortunate enough to get hired at an architecture firm, and so I kind of moved
Back
away from the building.
That, right, a little bit.
Moved away, and so... you know, a few months later, I reached out to my old boss at the city and asked him if he can put me in touch with Jamestown. And I reached out to them and said, you know, I shared some photos. I said, I started taking these photos. You know, would you guys mind if I came back? And, you know, in exchange for you guys using a little bit of this for your marketing and whatnot, would you allow me to access the building and just document the changes? Mm-hmm. And that turned into 6 years of documentation. Wow. And you know,
it took a while to build that.
Yeah, right? Almost 50 separate trips to the building.
Wow.
Every, you know, anywhere from every other week to every couple months. And then sometimes they would notify me if something major was happening, like if they were putting up the signs or pulling out a new wall and they would unveil something, you know, anything that was interesting, they would give me a heads up. And I, you know, I worked about a mile away, so I can just come right down with my stuff.
So what are some of the things that you discovered after they tore down something? Anything visually interesting?
Well, there was a couple times where they pulled back some old walls and revealed some of the original windows that had been covered up for 40 something years.
So the glass was still in them, everything.
The glass was it was still the steel, you know, frame of the window, but it's just very interesting.
They just put a wall on front of it.
Put some brick over it or something. So that was pretty interesting. And then when they tore out the old Sears cafeteria, that used to be located right on the rail trestle that came into the building. And so when they tore that out, you could see the actual like path of the railway that came right up into the building, because that used to be the original shipping point. Mm-hmm. Right there. It was pretty interesting.
Now, how did the book come about? So is that you got a publisher, or did you self-publish this yourself?
Right. So I had the first vision of the book in 2010 when I was starting those photos. I put together kind of a brief 10-page mock-up of, you know, what I saw this becoming. And at that time, I thought I was just, you know, those were the photos I had before it was going to be demolished, I thought. And
you thought it was going to be demolished altogether?
Right, right. And so when I started going back and making additional visits, then the book started turning into now really have this opportunity to capture this certain moment in time in our city's history, this transition of the building, and something that folks won't really get a chance to see unless you take a tour. And so... In 2015, I got in touch with the Sears historian, Jerry Hancock, who wrote the essay in the book. He's extensively studied Sears and their impact in the Southeast, and he actually started some of the original tours when Jamestown, they reached out to him and said, can you do some tours here?
Right.
And so we got together.
He's local?
Yes, yeah. And I asked him if he could contribute a historical essay. And, you know, I showed him my mock-up. And at that time, I just used like fake text to show this is right. where I would like your historic essay right. to be. And this is how it fits into the book. And so, you know, we worked on that. And then late in 2016, I had the full manuscript ready to go. And so I started reaching out to publishers. And of course, there's plenty of rejection at the time. But I only had to find one.
Oh,
so,
he needs one.
Yeah, and we were very close to self-publishing. I was working with Jamestown to actually
just do it themselves.
Jamestown project. Right, let's team up. And so I had everything lined up, ready to pull the trigger. And then one of the publishers that I reached out to months before said, hey, is it still available? I'm like, absolutely, it's still available. And so a couple months after that, we signed a deal with Schiffer Publishing up in Pennsylvania.
And then so they took over, then you sent them all the photos, and did they use your mock-up or they just...
Yeah, I sent the entire manuscript and said, guys, it's already
pretty much done.
Here
you just have to kind of print it.
Yeah,
now.
So we went through a couple rounds of proofing and, you know, editing and that sort of thing. But for the most part, it was a relatively smooth process.
And so that was your first book. Do you plan on other books?
You get the itch, I guess, and kind of start thinking about what the next thing could be. So I have a couple ideas of what might come next, but it was certainly a fun process for sure.
Is Jamestown helping you distribute it? Because it's kind of a infomercial for them, right?
Exactly. Well, so they have a substantial number of copies with them, and so they're using them anywhere between, you know, marketing themselves, gifts, I don't know, like you said, like if they're looking for potential properties, I'm sure right. they're saying, hey, here's a little brochure.
This is how we transform this one.
right. Here's a clear record of what
you have
done.
Like a complete documentation
exactly.
of the before and the after.
Yeah, I know they're very thrilled with the finished product. They've been amazingly, you know, helpful throughout the process, mm-hmm. supportive every step of the way.
So now if somebody wants to get their hands on the book, where can they find it?
So there's physical copies. There's Posman Books. That's the bookstore in Ponce City Market. Mm-hmm. Mark Stiles over there, he has a stock of the books there. Some of them are already signed by myself and Jerry. If you want to find one online, you can go to my website. It's blakeburtonphotography.com. And there's a button on the left-hand side that says Ponce City Market Book. And that'll take you to the publisher's website to purchase.
Good stuff. Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.